Welcome to SCOTUSCast. On April 21st, 2008, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Enquist v. Oregon Department of Agriculture. The case asked whether the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and in particular the Class of One Doctrine, extends to public employee decisions, prohibiting a government employer from intentionally treating an employee differently from similarly situated employees when it has no rational basis to do so. Professor Epstein of the University of Chicago Law School discusses the case. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
This is Richard Epstein, a professor of law at the University of Chicago and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. This brief broadcast on behalf of the Federalist Society is to comment on a recent oral argument that took place in the United States Supreme Court in the case of Anoop Enquist, E-N-G-Q-U-I-S-T, versus the Oregon Department of Agriculture. This case has to do with the application of a somewhat exotic doctrine which developed originally in the context of land use regulation cases under the Equal Protection Clause. The precise question is whether or not a clause which seems to be directed towards the disparate treatment between different classes of individuals can apply in those cases in which there is a class of one and only one person. In the land case that took place in the year 2000, the question was whether or not a landowner who had been arbitrarily and capriciously denied a hookup to a sewer system could sue as a member of a class of one in order to get either damages for or the specific connection to the hookup in question. And the Supreme Court, with some obvious reluctance, thought that given the totally arbitrary nature of the decision and the lack of any conceivable justification for it, meant that the class of one doctrine would allow at least this person, if not anybody else, to get some form of relief. In the Enquist situation, the case all of a sudden shifts from the question of regulation to the question of employment. And now, in this situation, the question that we have to answer, quite simply, is whether or not an employee in the particular case who held the position as a international food standards specialist in the Oregon Department of Agriculture could, in fact, invoke the same doctrine when she claimed that a rival worker seeking the same promotion that she sought and her superior had conspired in a wholly arbitrary and capricious way to deny her a promotion, which eventually resulted in her leaving the job. The pattern of behavior which they alleged is common in many employment-type situations. It's that she was disfavored by the employer, that her work was slowly reduced, that after a while her position was seen to be no longer necessary, and she was essentially let go. And the instructions that were given at the trial level allowed her to bring this action, and she was able to recover, in fact, $175,000 in compensatory damages and $125,000 in punitive damages. I'm in a somewhat odd position in making a commentary on this case because after some real considerable doubt about the matter, I actually joined in an amicus brief with the American Civil Liberties Union saying that some limited version of the class of one doctrine ought to apply in employment cases. The reason I find this a very difficult situation is I've spent so many years as an academic talking about labor markets thinking that the doctrine of contract at will, which allows an employer to fire or a worker to quit for good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all, should in fact carry over to all labor cases. And this in effect says that arbitrary and irrational behavior by employers will in fact be constrained by the market, so it's a hopeless effort to try to find out whether a good cause or a bad cause happened to motivate a particular decision. When you get into the public area, however, I think the balance of convenience changes because I don't think that a public employer is in the same position as a private employer. The public employer has fiduciary duties of fairness with respect to all individuals. So the question that one has to face in these kinds of cases is whether you can develop a standard which allows you to get rid of the worst kinds of behaviors that individual employers, including government employers, can engage in without making essentially the Equal Protection Clause the home for a civil service operation, which means that virtually every kind of dismissal will be subject to some kind of review under a constitutional standard. Can one articulate that particular line? It turns out that I wasn't the only person who was worried about this. When one reviews the transcripts of the oral arguments in the Supreme Court, it was quite clear that both sides were badgered with exactly the same question. on the behalf of the petitioner, the argument went as follows from the Supreme Court. How can you possibly articulate a standard that does not open up the floodgates? If, in fact, you want to decide that there is no reason at all, what are you going to do if somebody alleges, well, I decided not to keep this person because, frankly, I didn't like her very much? Would that count as a reason? And Katyal, arguing for the petitioner, gamely sort of answered, well, probably yes, it would count as a reason because I only want this thing to be very, very narrow. But how much narrower can that be? The Supreme Court seemed to come back. And he was at some point genuinely befuddled as to whether or not he could make a test which was broad enough to have some particular bite, but narrow enough so as not to open those kinds of floodgates. And it seemed to me that when you read the first half of the oral argument, the Supreme Court was quite skeptical of the way in which the position went. That's until you heard the second half of the argument when the government came forward. And here the situation was reversed. The questions put to the government lawyer was, look, it turns out that we now have a case in which it is announced publicly that a given person was not hired or retained or promoted because a bribe had been paid by the father of a rival candidate for the same position, and the agency decided that the bribe was more important than the merit selection. Are you going to tell us that that's the kind of case that we can't figure out what's going on? So essentially what the Supreme Court justices did was they gave a case in which there was a screamingly inappropriate motive publicly announced, and then say, do we really want to have a per se rule no employment cases ever get tested under the Equal Protection Clause? And it turned out that the government lawyers were very unhappy about that, and so they were willing to concede that some cases might apply, perhaps sometimes, but certainly not this case, or to take the other position, to argue that if that kind of behavior takes place, then you've got other remedies under other kinds of statutes, there are other kinds of institutional checks that come in, don't bring the institutional heavy hardware of the Equal Protection Clause to bear on the particular case. Now, as you look at these arguments, it turns out, I think, that they're pretty close. And so why is it that I think, on balance, that the Supreme Court ought to keep the door ajar, but not allow it to be opened very much? And I think the argument really rests upon the conception of limited government. If you have a government which can arbitrarily move favors from one person to another person, in the end, the liberty of no person is going to be fully secure. So just as administrative law has to deal with arbitrary and capricious action, it seems that in the cases where there's no institutional structure, you probably want to have some gentle form of constitutional intervention in these cases. But there is still this kind of very difficult puzzle problem that you have to deal with. Go back to the comparison that I mentioned at the beginning of this little talk between the cases of government refusals to issue permit and the decisions of the government not to hire or to promote an individual employee. To my mind, there is no doubt that we want much more government scrutiny in those cases where permits are at stake than where jobs are at stake. And the explanation has to do with the shape and the organization of the market. If the government can deny you a permit, you can't go and work for somebody else. You've got to get that permit or you're out of business. So its monopoly control acts like a stranglehold on individuals. And under those circumstances, I think any test that starts to talk about conceivable government reasons for denying a permit are actually far too weak. What I think ought to be done is there should be a fairly close examination to make sure that the permit is denied for reasons that would allow the state to punish individuals if the conditions involved came to pass. So you can enjoin the construction of a building if you think it's going to create a flood, precisely because you could stop the flood once it occurred and punish the people who created it with a tort kind of action or with fines or damages. So here's the way I think the lay of the land ought to be. I think the use of any conceivable reason in the employment context is pretty much about the right standard, and I'm not really sure whether or not Ms. Enquist would win or lose under that standard, although obviously she got this far because the case seemed to be one that raised more than one eyebrow. But I think it's much more important to keep separation between the employment cases and the land use regulation cases, and to do that, what the Supreme Court has to do is undertake a much more large and systematic and searching examination of the following simple question. Why is it when somebody has monopoly power over private individuals, any conceivable reason will do the job to allow them to wipe out projects of undoubted merit? And so the real question here is how to maintain the disparity, and the proper answer to that question is to create a situation where we tighten the scrutiny in the land use cases and leave the employment cases about where the plaintiff wants them to be. Anyhow, that's the way in which I look at this thing. This is Richard Epstein speaking on behalf of the Federalist Society. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.